This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing. No!
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
The day of the monster uprising was the day I lost everyone. Only a small fraction of humanity survived to move underground. I've been scanning for Amy the entire time. And now I finally found her.
Right, welcome back everyone to Cinematic Animalia, the podcast where the monsters aren't real, but the science is. We break down the biology of movie monsters. Today we're looking at 2020's sleeper hit, I guess you could call it. Sleeper hit is one that doesn't do terribly well, but I guess no movies did terribly well at all last year. So,
Bloodshot.
Fair enough.
Oh yeah, Bloodshot, yeah. And Bad Boys for Life, right? But the movie is Love and Monsters. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and we'll get stuck into the biology of the world of Love and Monsters. As always, the show is going to be broken up into a few different segments. We'll have time codes below so you can skip ahead if there's something particular that you're looking for. But before we get to that, let me just take a second here, and Dave, I'd appreciate if you could add some reverb to this. My name is Dr. Sam Perrin.
Doctor.
Yeah. I'm a freshwater invasive ecologist, formerly, I should say now, of the Norwegian University for Science and Technology. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, alongside co-host Adam Harsick, a soon-to-be doctor. We'll make a very big deal of that, and then it'll be in about a month. There'll be the most pretentious episode ever. It'll just be me, Dave, and I'm just going, what do you think, Doctor? Doctor, what's your opinion?
Can't wait.
Yay.
Oh, Libby, it'll be so fun.
Libby want to get to not only be the only female, but the only non-doctor.
Yeah. Oh, we're going to gatekeep so hard. But Adam is a PhD candidate at the University of Arkansas and a parasite ecologist and a disease ecologist. He's not a parasite.
It's the same thing, but whatever.
Yeah. I mean, we're humans. We're all former parasites, right?
Sure.
Babies. And alongside Adam, this week is Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. And as always, we're joined by Dave, who is a vet and our movie physiologist. Whew, so it's been a while.
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't know if you caught when, you know, initially I mentioned that I was a doctor now. I did it fairly subtly, so some of you might not notice. But yeah, since last time, I've finished my PhD. Adam is 2 weeks away from defending?
No, I am about 2 weeks away from turning in the thesis, and then I will be defending in 5 weeks.
Ooh.
April 16th.
How tense is your sphincter right now?
Not too tense.
Okay, good to know. Yeah. We might have to bleep that out. We're going for family friendly. I don't know.
Well, I mean, the podcast is rated S for science and swearing, so...
Yeah.
S for science, swearing, and sphincters.
Gotta edit.
Yeah.
Alliteration.
Yeah, what else has been happening? Dave, have you got any earth-shattering news?
No, we're just crazy busy. And I think that's, like, if I'm looking for an excuse for our delay, it's just for reasons that no one completely explained during this pandemic, we thought that we were going to be walking into a really quiet year for veterinary medicine. We were like, people aren't going to necessarily have money. People aren't necessarily going to be all that, you know, worried. They're going to try to conserve things and only bring them in if they need to. And instead, everybody has adopted a cat or a dog to keep them comfortable and keep them friendly during this pandemic. And as a result, I am currently booked like 3 months out for all of like my exam appointments and everything like that. It's just, it's insane. We're like, no one thought it was going to be this busy. We were like, oh, it's going to be a quiet year. And then it was like, you were wrong.
Yeah, that sounds like a horrifying year, Dave. We just bought a house recently, and we're thinking of getting getting another pet later this year. And we were going to get it a bit earlier, but a family friend was just like, maybe you wait until the end of the year when all the people who bought pets during the pandemic get rid of these pets that they can't take care of after the pandemic.
Yeah.
All the kittens and puppies grow up and they don't want them anymore.
Well, it's just home life. Mm-hmm. Like, my partner and I were discussing this recently. Like, we have cats, and cats are easy enough to just say, like, ah, like, we'll just leave you at home. We can give you a couple of days. But even then, we still have to organize to have friends check in on them if we go away, like, pre-pandemic. And I think the people who are like, well, this is easy. I'm home all day. I'm working from home. The dog's with me. When you get back and it's like, oh, I want to do a trip to Norway, or I want to, like, go down and, like, go on this big, long visit, they're going to have to find ways to deal with the dog. And I think it's going to be tougher than they're expecting. I mean, I love that the humane shelters have emptied out for, like, the first time ever. They're like, we're out of dogs. And that's awesome.
Hell yeah.
But we don't know if that will last. I mean, we hope.
Welcome to Rescue Dog Rescue, a superhero edition. You know our motto. With great power comes Great Dane's responsibility.
Anyway, yeah, so as we've mentioned, Adam and I have been going through the, you know, the final stages of our thesis, which is why we kind of haven't recorded since, what, July last year?
I think so. Outlander came out a couple months later.
But we are back now, and thanks to Libby jumping on board, we have, you know, lots and lots of content lined up, and we should be able to, you know, get weekly episodes going again. So thanks for everybody who's, you know, stuck with us over this enormous hiatus.
Been patient.
Yeah.
We appreciate you listening in now.
We hope our number one super fan, Wolf, is still out there recommending movies.
Yeah.
We finally did your movie. Yeah. It was great.
Yes. I don't know. It was fun to podcast, and it was a great movie.
It was better than this one.
Ignore.
Whoa. Whoa. Yeah. Okay. That's a big...
Guess what? This movie sucked.
Adam has thoughts.
You did not like the movie we're doing today.
You didn't? Okay, fair enough.
I hate it.
I didn't hate it, but I also was not a fan.
Okay, Sam and I are on very different pages.
Get ready for a fight.
Let's get stuck in. Basically, before we get stuck into this movie and talk about it, we'll do a little bit of news here, because the thing I want to tell everybody about is March Mammal Madness, which has just started. So basically, this is a thing that happens every March, where a bunch of mammalologists.
Aren't you a doctor?
No,
I'm not. Yeah,
fish doctor.
Ecologists who study mammals, basically, get on Twitter and simulate fights between mammals. I don't mean like, you know, Pokemon kind of fights where you just throw them at each other.
Ooh, virtual dog fighting.
They come up with, you know. Yeah, they come up with like a semi-realistic scenario of how these two animals might meet, and kind of go into like explaining the biology behind everything and how the two mammals might interact and that sort of stuff. It's basically a much more thought out, well researched version of, you know, the verses that we've done previously at the end of episode, and it's really interesting. And they get, you know, specialists from all across the world to chime into this. So if you go on Twitter and search March Mammal Madness. Highly recommend checking it out. For instance, you could even start with a coyote versus pygmy hippo, which was an absolute laugh.
That's hilarious.
It's really funny. It's really educational. So, yeah, give it a Google.
Or give it a ding.
Here's something you've never, ever heard before. Hey, good question. You should bing it.
Well, you don't believe me? Bing it.
Okay, maybe once. But except maybe as a punchline, nobody uses Bing.
Right. So, today, we are looking at Love and Monsters, a movie which came out last year. Should have gotten a bigger release, but of course, you know, movie cinemas weren't open in large parts of the world. Dave, do you want to take us through kind of the plot of the movie and what happens?
Sure. So, the general idea of the movie involving a meteorite moving its way towards Earth and eventually striking it, causing chaos, damage, destruction. In the process, a change takes place such that the meteorite releases or activates something leading to worldwide mutation of only cold-blooded organisms. And the cold-blooded organisms... Oh, wait, why is Adam giving me weird looks?
From the intro of the movie, they destroyed the movie with rockets, and the chemicals from the rockets is what caused everything.
Was it?
Yeah, like all the chemicals falling back down to Earth after the rockets.
Right, from the meteorite, right, that ended up releasing... Well, Adam, you've watched this more recently than I did. I watched this like a month ago. Does Adam want to take us through the intro?
Actually? Sure. So you have a world being narrated by the world's most annoying character in existence. who is just a walking pile of quirkiness and terribleness.
No, Adam.
Sam, just take it home. Oh, Adam, you're being removed from this role.
Okay.
The meter's destroyed. Okay. Rockets blow it up. All the chemicals come down and they mutate invertebrates, reptiles, amphibians, everything that is, quote, cold-blooded, and they destroy the world in 7 years.
Yeah, there's a massive war, basically. The military, you know, fights against all these monsters. Doesn't go well for the military, doesn't go well for anybody. I think they say 99.9% of the human population was wiped out in, like, in a couple of days or
95.
Okay, yeah. So a massive chunk of the population is wiped out. The remainder of humanity is kind of living in little groups in bunkers all over the world. Humanity hasn't been wiped out, but it's not going very well. And it's the story of one man who is real horny and decides he's going to travel across country to cop a route, basically.
Yeah.
His former girlfriend, he's just found out where his former girlfriend before this whole thing started, is set up, and he takes a journey across, I think it's something like 50 miles,
85
kilometers or something like that. 85 miles?
Yeah, it's about 130 kilometers.
About 130 kilometers to try and find her. And along the way, you know, runs into a bunch of monsters, runs into Michael Rooker and his surrogate daughter.
Hell yeah, best part of the movie.
Yeah. And hijinks ensue.
And he also meets Sam's absolute favorite character from the entire movie along the way.
Boy.
It is a Australian cattle dog.
Oh, just the best dog ever. Like, okay, so major spoiler here, but my enjoyment of this movie really hinged on whether or not that dog survived.
Oh, same.
And the dog survived.
I got messages throughout Sam watching the movie that was like, look, I'm enjoying this and it's great and all, but let me tell you right now, this movie is a piece of shit if this dog dies.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't, and I was so happy. But there is one scene where a giant centipede is like attacking, and it goes for the dog instead of Dylan O'Brien. And oh my god, I was.
That dog was so cute.
Boy, it was great. But I gotta tell you, the dog did survive, and the movie was still shit.
Yeah. Okay. So why do you think this movie was shit, Adam? Because we'll go, Dave. Maybe we can go into why we liked it later on. But Adam, why did you not like this movie?
I think that this movie was trying to do two different things that were diametrically opposed at the same time. They're trying to make this character be capable, while also make him be completely incapable of anything. I also didn't think that he was a very good actor, which affected a lot of this. But it all started with the beginning of them having a conversation in his home bunker about what they're going to do, and him just speaking out of nowhere, like, I'm going to go see her! Like, just like that. Like, no subtlety, no acting ability. Just talking over people having a conversation. Like, this is not how real life works. This is not interesting as an actor. But they've established that this world is incredibly dangerous. Everything is trying to kill you. And he walks around like the biggest bumbling fucking idiot. Literally falls into a hole because he's looking at a book while he's walking. He is screaming. He is always loud. And he does not die. You cannot have this world that is dangerous, but not dangerous at the same time.
He had a pretty heavy layer of plot armor on.
Yeah. I will say that I agree, like, when he talks at the end, because at the end, you know, he does survive, and he's like, everybody else, get out there and, you know, give it a go. We can take our world back. And I'm like, dude, you were very lucky to survive this. You should not be telling other people.
Most people are
going to
die.
Right. And they do, right? I mean, the bunker is shown to repeatedly during, like, the little cases where they're just simply repelling a couple of ants. People die. And in just as a quick rebuttal to Adam's point, this movie is currently at 92% on Rotten Tomatoes, so...
Yeah.
I saw, and I disagree.
I don't think I can recall something where I'm so opposed, because I thought Dylan O'Brien, I have seen him before in, like,
Maze Runner kid.
Yeah, and I thought he was an absolute charisma vacuum in that. I thought he was terrible. But in this, I thought he was really funny.
I really enjoyed him.
Like,
yeah,
I agree with you. I thought Maze Runner, he was bad. And this movie, he just leveled up his acting chops.
He was fun, and they didn't have to make him some super wasteland badass or anything like that. But they also didn't have to make him hated by the group just because he's not good at killing things. Like, he's still well-liked. They're like, he cooks. He's a nice guy. Yeah. We just don't want him fighting things.
And yeah, I did like the way they treated that whole dynamic between him and Jessica Henwick, who, fantastic, by the way. I don't understand why they keep giving her an American accent, having just seen her in Underwater, but doesn't matter. But like, because I thought that there was going to be this whole, oh, he gets there and she doesn't even want him. She's horrible. But it's not really that. It's like kind of, she appreciates it. But I mean, it's been 7 years.
Right.
Like,
she had a life. Yeah.
Yeah, she had a life. And
she has no agency in this movie. She exists to be a foil, her character. He gets there. She expressly tells him that I do not want you. I lost somebody that I loved last year. And I'm recovering from this.
Yeah.
And he says, okay, cool. I'm going to kiss you anyway. And all of a sudden, she has amnesia. And she's like, I'm going to find you now. Like, go fuck yourself, movie. She has zero agency. She gets completely wiped.
Okay. I didn't end up finding that from her character. I thought that, like, I enjoyed her initial response of, like, hey, I don't know if this is something I want to jump into. This is cute. I did lose someone, like, a year ago. And even the end, it's not set up in a fact that they're going to engage in a, like, romantic relationship at the end.
I would disagree with that.
I felt like he fights the crab, they get into the whole battle, but that's also mutual assured destruction. If they don't fight the crab and the dickhead Australian pirates, they're going to die.
Completely unnecessary characters.
Yeah, okay, so this is the big question I have for Libby in this part of the show, right? It's because a lot of the time when you've got, like, giant monsters out there and they're seen as the main villain, there's also, like, generally a kind of a human villain that they sneak in there just to... And this movie almost avoided that. I actually didn't, because normally in any other movie when this Aussie guy pops up at the end who's way too nice, I'd be like... You're definitely a bad guy. But with this movie, I was like, it had kind of, you know, trumped my expectations a little bit. So I didn't know if that was going to happen.
Libby called it within 2 seconds.
I didn't really know. I suspected it was probably going to be that, but I didn't know 100%. But Libby, do you think they could have just avoided that completely? Would it have still had the same, like, could they have?
Absolutely. It's funny, when we first started watching this, I turned to Adam and I made a comment. I said, you know, I really like and appreciate that this is a post-apocalyptic movie that doesn't have humans fighting whatever the disaster is, whether that's monsters or just, like, nuclear fallout or, you know, the dystopia. But I appreciate it that it wasn't humans fighting each other on top of that. I feel like that is a really common trope in dystopian movies, for everybody to be a shitheel and, like, out to, you know, capture a group of people or steal all the resources and things like that. And I get it, that might be likely what happens and blah, blah, blah. But I feel like it's a trope that those types of movies fall back on. And it was kind of refreshing not to have that. Like, when he first emerges out of the bunker and immediately the first two people he runs into are like, hey, let's help each other. And I was like, oh my God, this is so pleasant.
Although they do think that he's a food stealer right off the bat.
Yeah, but they don't, like, hold him at gunpoint and, like, you know, time up for a couple days before they, like, learn to trust him or whatever. It was just kind of refreshing not to have to deal with that sort of aspect. And then, of course, they deal with that aspect in the very end. They introduce the shitty human villain. I agree. I think that it could have completely been avoided. I don't think it was necessary. It was, for me, I could see it from a mile away when the second she said this cruise ship, you know, on the radio when she's talking to the main character, she tells him of this cruise ship that's coming. I'm like, okay, that's not good.
Yeah.
So I think that they could have had some sort of big monster battle at the end, you know, as they did, but where he's using all the skills that he's learned in 7 days.
Okay. Yeah. I will also say it was completely unnecessary for them not to just bring the crab up onto the shore and have it eat the people while they were sleeping. The reveal of the crab where the Australian's like, oh, I'm going to bring it up and, like, give you guys the ability to fight
The classic Bond villain, like, let me explain my evil plan.
Why? Why wouldn't you just, like, they were asleep for hours. We go from the middle of the night to, like, mid-mornings, early afternoon, and, like, they wake up just for the Australian to be like, ah, finally you're awake. Now I can sick my crab on you. Like, why not hours ago?
Why did the crab not just sink the boat?
Why do you have a crab being the thing that's going to swim through the water for you and pull your boat?
The worst swimmer.
Famously, a benthic organism. It lives on the floor of the ocean. They don't swim normally.
Maybe it's just walking and pulling the boat to the super long anchor.
That could work.
I really adored his scene with the communication with the robot. the robot that he finds.
That was the best
Mavis.
That was just, it was really great, and it was an interesting look at the world, and I appreciated the idea of, like, yes, the world is, like, scary, and there's a lot of, like, creatures out there, but it can still be beautiful, even if, like, you can't make a pet out of it.
Yeah, and the bit where the robot, like, shows him a photo of his mum, who he doesn't have a photo of at all, I'm just like, that is, that, yeah, that was...
Yeah.
And then the robot dies, like, a second later, and he's just alone again. That was, This movie, like, it had a lot of heart.
It had some heart.
It was really funny, but it just, everyone was so nice. Michael Rooker and his daughter were so nice, and then...
Yeah, and it was a cute scene as well, where they're training him, and yes, I get it, 7 days. Learning to be a good archer in 7 days is not great. But I loved his relationship with the dog. I loved the, like, self-sacrifice with the grenade for the giant worm. Although I rewatched that scene last night, and it goes, like, he's supposed to be counting to five, and, like, 12 seconds pass before he throws the grenade. He just happens to say five when he throws the grenade, and I was like, ooh, that's so great.
That always makes me so anxious in movies, when it's been, like, 10 seconds. I'm like, oh, my God. Could nobody on the set count?
But, like, I loved the, like, logically, just let the dog get eaten. But any of us would be like, no, I don't want the dog eaten. Like, it's my dog. Don't eat my dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think from a story point of view, I was kind of hoping, and they never did it, I was kind of hoping that the romance in the story and the romance side of the narrative, the original owner of the dog, of Boy, would still be alive. And he found, like, would rescue her, find her, and that would be his, like, soulmate or, like, love interest.
Or she would rescue him, Libby.
Well, yeah.
And I don't want to hear your sexist values on who rescues who.
But remember, Dave, this movie can't decide what it wants to do, and you're going to have Amy be a very capable person and lead her colony to success, and then say, like, you get the monster. I can handle these three people. She can't handle it at all. He has to rescue her again. Like, you decide what this movie is going to be.
She does charge a man with a shotgun carrying a piece of a metal shield and knocks him through a shed.
Not physically possible.
Not just a man, a very large man.
A brick shithouse of a man.
I would argue that was a very capable woman, all right?
Disregards the laws of physics.
Yeah, I have heard this argument, like, go back and forth between a couple of podcasters as well on the agency that Jessica Henwick's character has. But I don't know, I'm obviously, Dave and I are on a very different side of this to Adam, with Libby sitting right in the middle. I think this was, I love this. And as my kind of final thought, it was really fun to see these kind of Australian character actors and the Australian bush, like, front and center in the movie. Although, as Libby pointed out to me, Bruce Spence, who was, like, the really tall guy, people might know him as the weirdo from The Matrix, the train station guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually from New Zealand, but he identifies as Australian now, much like Russell Crowe does. So until he beats someone over the head with a telephone, he's Australian to me. And the Aussie bush, it just looked so good. Like, it made me homesick. I really wanted to, just get home and visit a winery and go for a hike.
Fight a giant crab.
You guys actually have crabs the size of that over there, right?
Yeah. That was weird that they introduced such a realistic animal.
That's what carried Sam across the pond. That's why he figured this out. He was like, they got crabs attached to boats.
It's a much more sustainable form of travel.
Pulled his yacht.
Welcome to North Queensland, Australia. Fancy a swim in a tropical paradise?
You can't do that here because there's crocodiles.
Oh, but don't worry, they've made a sign.
Oh, apparently there's massive prehistoric beasts out there, so just take care.
She'll be right.
Alrighty. Before we start looking at the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Sam Perrin, NTNU. Adam is at Harsic Adam. We're also at C_Animalia. If you want to get in touch with the podcast directly, we're going to start using the Twitter account a lot more. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit cinematicaanimalia.com or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to check out Libby's writing, you can visit www.shortstorysoup.substack.com. And if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam and I write about, check out ecologyforthemasses.com. Oh, that list has really grown over the last 2 years.
That's what she said.
Okay, so I guess that the kind of the obvious thing that we should start off with is that none of these creatures that we see are related in any way.
No.
Like, What do we see? We see a snail, so you're going to mollusk.
Mollusk.
Crab.
Ant. Arthropod.
Yeah.
Looks like a cockroach. That doesn't look like an ant to me.
There's a centipede. Yeah.
The frog.
Big ass frog. Yeah. What was the queen supposed to be? Because it looked a little bit like a lamprey, but I wasn't exactly sure.
Completely made up monster.
Yeah, the sand gobblers.
I think they're supposed to be worms, based on like what I was reading in terms of their like, because they're supposed to be, because that's the dens that they're doing, the growths, the moving underground, and so it fits with their kind of, we're considering insects to be cold-blooded organisms.
I think that could work, but an important consideration I want to bring up there and for this movie is that most of these organisms are not insects. They are arthropods, or they're invertebrates, but very few of them are actually insects, which are a distinct group of organisms.
Yeah, I think it was just the... What insects did we see? Because there were some. There was the ant, right?
The ant cockroach thing at the very beginning. The chumbler looked like a gigantic beetle. I did think, though, with the sand gobbler queen.
Yeah, because the names do get a bit... I got mixed up a lot with the different names.
I do, too.
Yeah, but it's very obvious that there were kind of names that had been given by a...
A seven-year-old girl.
Yeah. I just wanted to see the snow spiders.
Same. I think that would have just been the spiders from The Mandalorian.
But yeah, the justification that's given is that there are all the cold-blooded things. And I think we went through the cold-blooded isn't really that helpful a term scientifically. I mean, look, it's easy to teach kids with, but it's not really that helpful a term scientifically. I think we did this in an earlier episode, but we can go through it again quickly now.
It's not really accurate.
So a lot of the time we think of cold-blooded creatures as things like, reptiles.
Mostly reptiles.
Basically things that aren't birds or mammals, which is kind of the distinction you have here. But there are plenty of reptiles which run body temperatures and blood temperatures at like much higher levels than us and than most mammals, to be honest. And there are lots of mammals and birds that have really low standard core body temperatures as well. So it's not really that helpful a term biologically. Two other terms that get thrown around a lot are poikilothermy and homeothermy. Poikilothermy is basically something that varies its body temperature a lot.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's massive variation. So again, normally that would be something like a reptile, which requires the environment to, maintain it, get it warm again. Spend, things like iguanas, which spend some time basking in the sun. And homeotherms, which keep their temperature at a very, very... a small kind of like interval, like we do. And then you also have endotherms and ectotherms. Endo means, you kind of generate a core body temperature, using food and metabolism, that sort of stuff. And ectotherm means that majority of your body temperature is generated by the external factors, when you warm yourself up. Now, those two don't always coincide. You have some creatures that like generate their own body temperature, but it does vary wildly. And you have other creatures like the iguanas I mentioned before, so that was probably a poor example, who generate their body temperature using external sources like the sun, but they can keep that body temperature at a very small range as well. So cold-blooded doesn't really mean anything, and obviously it doesn't really have anything to do with why these creatures mutated. But Dave, you have some thoughts on that, right?
Yeah, so... Exactly. They're not connected in terms of these different groups. So looking over everything and trying to figure out one, because, we are a podcast that tries to make these things work. Is there a way that we can connect the organisms that we see? And two, is there a way that we can connect how they would potentially be mutated? So, I mean, the easiest answer is going to be some type of mutagen. So mutagens are compounds that cause alterations to take place in the DNA at their simplest form, and they're either inherited or non-inherited changes. Obviously, to be inherited, they're going to have to be something that actually alters the sexual or reproducing cells that you can pass on from one organism to another. And the three sort of most common types are either physical, so heat, radiation, chemical, various compounds that go in that cause your DNA sequences to shift or change, or biological, viruses, transposons, different types of changes. So bacteria in some rare cases can actually cause alterations as well to try and trigger what we're going to be seeing to take place. And that does happen. I was finding NASA's actually done some really cool experiments where they've sent up spores into space and exposed them to radiation. and they've seen major alterations take place with their DNA. However, one, the meteorite isn't bringing UV radiation into the atmosphere when it's there. And two, it's unclear whether or not it's the material released from the meteor or chemicals from the rockets that trigger this type of massive evolution. So, mechanism that could work would either be one, the rockets went up and they released some type of compound from either themselves or the rockets that gets rapidly absorbed into the ecosystem and starts triggering massive mutations. Or two, it releases some sort of biological organism that was already present on the meteorite, so some type of spore or bacteria or virus that starts causing rapid evolution, or not evolution, rapid mutation of certain types of affected organisms. The biggest problem with that is, one, any chemical that's going to be released, if it's going to have effects on the grouping of organisms we see, is going to affect everybody, right? Mainly cancer rates. All right, so, I mean, maybe that's why 95% of the human population just dropped, is just cancer rates went through the roof. Or if it's some type of virus or other organism, it's going to be targeting groups within the same family group, which, as we discussed, none of these organisms are. So the closest connection that I can get, sort of looking at three of the biggest organisms we see, one being the giant frog, one being the potentially mutated earthworm, and one being the crab, would be that it's going to be some type of chemical that's released that's going to preferentially affect animals with more permeable membranes. We know that frogs, and it turns out worms and crabs to a certain extent, are all used as canary in the coal mines in ecology terms. This would be more in Sam and Adam's areas. But that's why we talk about amphibian populations dropping, and they're like, they're a really good marker of chemical contamination.
Bioindicators.
So that if these compounds have been released and they're just getting pulled up by these organisms that mainly have a moist or aquatic. So earthworms are going to be more affected by toxic rain chemicals that basically get manipulated in. So again, contamination of water, because air isn't going to work for this. Crabs are going to more readily uptake through gills and other membranes. They're going to experience higher rates of compounds like heavy metal or other alkylating agents or even base analogs when it comes to chemical contamination. And frogs are just going to get screwed the same way frogs always do when humans screw around with chemicals. The last biggest problem with that whole thing is exactly as we discussed. Mutations are just simply the idea that your DNA, your base plan that tells Adam to grow to a certain height and Sam to grow to a different one, that forms our fingers, our organs, that tells the body where to go, that basic blueprint gets altered, shifted, or changed by a mutagen. If that's the case, most of the time, either it produces no change at all, it doesn't really make any big shift. Two, it produces unwanted mutations, so cancer, large amounts of cancer. Or three, the body just simply fixes that damage that's seen. And then the last thing for evolution, as Sam and Adam will attest to, evolution is not something that takes place over 7 years, right? Even if you do produce a mutation in an earthworm that, let's say, makes the earthworm slightly bigger, it's then going to have to reproduce. So we're going to have to hope that that mutation is inheritable. And then we're going to have to see a whole new lineage and line sort of grow up. And I did not know this. Do you know what the average lifespan for an earthworm is?
7 years.
Yeah.
7 years. Okay.
4 to 6 years, and earthworms in captivity can live up to 20. So we're not exactly going to be seeing a huge turnover that's going to be taking place here. The shortest living frogs live a full year, and they're ones that are found in super high altitude old environments. I'm trying to remember what the name of them are. They're kind of cool, but no one, even the people who study them, they're called Blanchett's cricket frog. They don't fully understand why they only live a year. Because most organisms don't. You're going to require a longer lifespan. And that takes place for the frogs, for the crabs, for the earthworms.
I think another issue there, or another thing to keep in mind, is that mutations are, by and large, neutral. Nothing happens.
Right.
When something, and that's like 80% of the time, when something does happen, it's usually bad.
Cancer.
When something good happens, that is like less than 1% of the time will a good, quote unquote, mutation happen.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, we could just be, but that's the thing, like, maybe, like, we're just seeing, because I mean, think about it, right? You have these species, right, that have evolved to live in very small areas. So there might be 1,000 frogs in a pond. If they all grow up, they're just going to wipe each other out immediately, which I'll talk a bit more about later. But so maybe it's just like only one in every 1,000 frog has, you know, mutated in this manner.
But in 7 years, we would see that type of change, that increase in biomass, that alteration.
Oh, no, I'm talking more in the terms of, you know, Ninja Turtle mutations. Like, overnight, they just grow into a massive thing. Like, obviously, they're not going to evolve in that way. And it's said in the movie to be a pretty immediate... It's said in the movie to be a pretty immediate change.
Right.
Thomas disagrees. Hi, my birds are also co-hosting this podcast, by the way. Normally, we get my son in. Eric couldn't make it today, so I brought the birds as extra co-hosts.
Right, I think the conceit of this movie is they're implying that they just... all these things just got big really fast.
Right.
Because the main story in the beginning of the movie is this guy's like, he loved his goldfish, and then it ate him. Like, you didn't notice your goldfish getting so large that it could literally eat you, and you didn't want to get rid of it or get away from it? Like, none of these things seem to be in stable populations. You only see one example of every creature except for the sand gobblers, which is a whole other thing. Just, these rules don't... they're not consistent, they don't quite make sense, and they also appear to alter the core biology and behavior of these organisms. Snails do not take care of their young, and that's what we see at the end of the movie. It does not make sense.
No,
that's the thing here. So, sorry,
Dave. No, I'm just completely agreeing with those points. Right, you don't... also, the fact that there would be no alteration that took place with mammalian organization or populations, or there wouldn't be any other shift taking place with those groups... it's just super, like, the sand gobblers, I was looking at that, like, picture, like, when he falls into the pit. I was rewatching that clip last night, and it is just filled with what looks to be, like, deer jawbones. And I was like, really?
And human.
Like, we don't have that many deer as it is, and they're going to keep falling into the damn pit over and over again? Like, no!
Also, if reptiles and amphibians are changing, so are birds, because birds are reptiles. Look it up.
Look it up on Ecology of Parnassus.
Look it up on every episode where Adam brings it up. We're going to have to write it on his tombstone.
But birds are reptiles. Do you see those sparrows above me? Reptiles. Oh, you know how, like, you have, like, little stone, like, sparrows or you know, great tits on top of a headstone sometimes? Just have a little, like, etching, like, these are reptiles, BTW, and then, like, a tiny URL link on top.
Perfect.
Okay, but anyway, assuming, like, this all could happen, like, these species all just grow giant overnight, it's still nothing works because all of these species have evolved to fill really small physical spaces. I mentioned before, like, the frogs, right? Even simpler than that. A fish can no longer fit in a river. Like, it's as simple as that. Like, you might get them surviving in deep lakes, but then they can't, you know, move from that lake to another lake. Mm-hmm. And even if it doesn't, like, run out of food straight away,
it will die.
Yeah, it will die. Yeah, like, it can't reproduce because...
it cannot get enough oxygen across its gills to survive. Yeah.
And, like, but terrestrial, semi-terrestrial animals. Let's take that frog, for instance, right? You used to have 1,000 frogs in a pond, say. You've now got one frog that can live in that pond. These frogs do. I mean, frogs, most of these species that we see here have life histories whereby they have massive amounts of young and don't take care of any of them.
Most of them die.
So you might see population explosions initially, but they have no resources to sustain this sort of stuff. So all of a sudden, you would have these populations that have gone way over their carrying capacity. A carrying capacity is kind of like the maximum population that you can have where resources aren't, like, overly stressed. So the population can survive quite happily at that number. Is that a reasonable explanation,
yep.
Adam?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. All of these species have suddenly overnight gone to way over carrying capacity.
The planet has gone over carrying capacity.
Yeah, big time. And what happens after a species goes over carrying capacity is you have, like, it's the populations are too dense and they crash. Generally, it's not always the case, of course, but generally the rate at which a population crashes is generally pretty similar to the rate at which it goes up. since these populations have gone so sky high overnight, they're going to crash real hard as well, and probably all just going to go extinct immediately.
Right. They're also all going to be extinct from the get-go because they're all mutated. They're all going to be sterile. Not a single one of them is going to be able to breed with another one. And the way mutations work is, outside of the frog example early on in the movie, mutations are not pretty. They're not symmetrical. You don't have this perfectly just bigger version of a centipede. Like, you'll have cancerous lumps. You'll have an uneven looking, disgusting frog thing, which was still way too symmetrical for what it was supposed to be. And the reason that you have, like, mules or ligers, which are real animals, can't breed is because their DNA does not fit together right, so they can't form functional sperm cells or egg cells. So none of these organisms are going to be reproducing. Humans will be fine in about 10 years.
Yeah, so my question for y'all is going to be, given the fact that these, you know, crossbreeds cannot reproduce, and then also given the fact that the carrying capacity is over, how long would it take for humans just to kind of wait it out and it'd be fine? Do you think, like, 10 years?
I think within about 10 years, you'd see most of them dying off.
Yeah. But that's the thing. It's like, how... Because all of these, I think that that's what we're seeing, kind of all of these species that he runs across, they're just like, you know, one or two of the last, maybe, I don't know, 10 or 20 across the whole continent. I keep forgetting this isn't set in Australia because it looks so Australian. North America.
California, specifically.
Yeah, it's supposed to be California. Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, I saw some gum trees at the start and I was like, I know that they have some invasive gum trees in California, so maybe it's California. But then, like, two scenes later, I was like, no, that is Victorian Highlands, dead set. Like, I love that place. But anyway, yeah, I think we're just seeing the last vestiges of every population. But I mean, that's the thing. That's still dangerous enough, obviously, for humans. And some of these species are going to do quite well. Like, some of these individuals are going to do quite well. Because you're essentially just introducing invasive species to a new area. And I mean, 60% of the world's biomass in terms of mammals is just cattle. So anything that can feed on cattle is going to do great for a while.
Another problem with this fucking movie. You cannot have a cow in a 2-meter by 1-meter space and keep it alive, happy, and healthy.
Well, the amount of food and water to keep that cow at a healthy level.
There are a lot of issues with the cow.
They're going on big hay runs.
How do they get the cow out of the bunker? Do you think you're going to get that cow 85 miles to this other bunker across this landscape that is supposed to be dangerous, but it's obviously not? No.
Right, and cows can be kept for long periods of time in something called tie stalls. Some cows, unfortunately, spend their entire life in a tie stall, but you guys bring up a perfectly good point. You have to supply a huge amount of food to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. They'd be better off just eating that food themselves.
The cow would not look that good after 7 years.
No.
Yeah. This is a question that I sometimes often get. It's like, because I love... eating tofu, right? I really enjoy tofu, and people are always like, yeah, but isn't soybeans really bad? I was like, yeah, but the majority of soybeans that get imported to Europe are to feed cows, right? So yeah, so you're better off just eating the soy. And that's the thing, like, they must be bringing in so much food to feed this cow. Like, just eat the food.
Yeah. Well, and the water too. The water is also what gets me, because cows take a lot of water daily to drink. And so it's like, where are they getting this underground water source from?
You would need a bull, right? You have to keep dairy cows pregnant in cycles to get them to continue to produce milk.
To lactate, yeah.
So
cows don't just produce milk. They're like every other animal. They need to be pregnant.
Right.
Or have a calf.
I don't think we introduced this at the start, so we should point out, yeah, they have a cow in their underground bunker, just tied up in the corner.
A large cow. A big dairy cow.
Yeah. But, yeah, so anything that can feed on cattle would do really well, but it doesn't change the fact that it's not going to be able to find a mate. Like, all these species, like, populations are going to crash super hard. A frog can't exist in, like, one pond anymore. It's going to need to move into a bigger lake, and then it's going to drive out all, you know, most of the other frogs if it can. Like, and also just the physical stuff. Like, they mentioned giant lizards climbing trees, but what tree is going to be big enough for a lizard that size anymore?
To support. Like,
Yeah, that we covered this in the Tremors episode, right? Like, you have things like earthworms, which rely on being able to get through the soil, like small spaces in the soil. They can't do that anymore if they're 5,000 times larger.
Also, just, I think we didn't say this earlier, but we should. Physically, none of these organisms can be that big.
Right, unless, I mean, in food source, biomass, the only possible explanation, because we don't see a lot of bodies, would just be, for whatever reason, whatever was released from the meteorite, as Sam points out, killed a huge amount of the cattle and human population just instantaneously, and there were enough organisms that were like, oh, I can just eat this and grow big.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I want to know, like, because we're talking about one end of the food chain, like all these animals becoming predators, but they're, of course, leaving this massive gap where they've disappeared from the base of the food web. What are all the insectivores eating? Like, of all, like, the antechinuses and, like, rats and that sort of stuff, have they just gone extinct because they have nothing to prey on?
Well, I feel like they would have been eaten, right?
Yeah, we don't see a huge amount of biodiversity.
But I mean, if they're that small, what's going to prey on them? Like, who's... like a tiny little bird. Maybe there's some medium sized.
Well, they do show the leeches at the end that are on him are not huge. I mean, they are definitely bigger than normal sized leeches, but they're not enormous like the frog or you know, the chumbler or whatever.
And you see the beetle in the house gets snatched by the plants or whatever it's supposed to be when he's walking by.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, I forgot about the mutated plants. Yeah.
If that's what that was. Really, none of these plants have changed. Yeah. No changes to bacteria, no changes to fungi, nothing.
But yeah, so Libby, you mentioned how long would it take everything to get back to normal. Like, okay, so we're going for another layer of what-if scenario. What if this theoretically worked and all these animals, like, readapted their life cycles? Would we be able to reach, like, a new equilibrium and would humans be able to fit into that?
Yeah.
I mean, this movie kind of ignores the fact that we wiped out megafauna before.
We wiped out everything.
Yeah, well, I mean...
You read these old pieces of people being, like, talking about elephants and rhinos being absolutely terrifying and, like, these giant animals that resisted our bullets. And then you run into a modern day where people have to get licenses to go out and hunt these things with rifles the size of Libby, and their population numbers continue to decrease. Like,
Dave, you haven't met... I think Adam would have been a fair comparison there, seeing as Libby is about 5 inches taller. Not 5 inches, but
I don't know. I was rewatching the movie though when they're like, "Yeah, the military just was no shape for this."
No and match.
Bullshit.
Right, and I was thinking about that great scene that Sam and I both love in the second Tremors. And Adam, you and I have talked about this before, where the guy with like the giant rifle that he says like it can shoot through anything, and he like shoots the creature, and then they have that scene of like the bullet's gone through the screamer, gone through a couple of metal barrels, gone through like the shed and then has gone through the truck, and the implication as they like pan out to like the desert going forward is that the bullet is still going to this day, and you're just like human weapons are fucking terrifying, guns are scary as shit.
We went over this with like the Quiets and the Dragon episode as well. We put the US military up against them. We're just like it's not a competition. Like,
no.
Yeah. So
there would be a group of American soldiers that would think this would be the most fun thing in the world to just go out and blast these giant frogs to pieces with rocket launchers.
Yeah.
Yep.
Not even soldiers, just like a group from Texas.
Right, exactly. Can you imagine the Martha Stewart cooking show of like, we've got ourselves some giant frogs. So what you want to do is a little bit of thyme, some light butter, and we're just going to put this in the oven for about 40 minutes.
Yeah. But I do, so Libby, you asked this before, like, could humans survive this? I mean, I think if they just went up north, like, to where shit's colder, and just waited it out, like, went up to Canada for a bit, I would really enjoy the whole, like, the reverse things of all the Americans just, like, flooding into Canada and Canadians being like,
we'd still have to be polite about it at the end of the day. Like, we would be internally a little bit annoyed, but it would come out in ways of just, like, really, like, not saying please when we're asking if you want a coffee or not.
A lot of passive aggressiveness.
And, cutting our thank yous down to, like, 50%.
Yeah. Australians would be screwed, though. There's nowhere in Australia that's cold enough to get away from these things.
Yep.
Maybe Tasmania, but that involves crossing a body of water, which I get the impression is not very safe in these in these movies.
Yeah.
Unless you have a crab.
Yeah.
But Libby, do you think that, like, even if that's, like, hanging over it, because they do kind of touch on that at the end of the movie, this whole, like, this is beatable, this is survivable. Do you think more movies should kind of lean into that? Like, this isn't necessarily the apocalypse, we can get past this?
I mean, I think in this case, for this movie, I was thinking about how, I mean, you're absolutely right. The military and just the grade of weapons that we have would absolutely
decimate creatures.
And one of the ideas that kind of popped into my head was if somehow every creature except humans started changing. Obviously, we run into the same physiological and ecological issue. But if you don't have just, you know, a couple of insects or, you know, salamanders here and there, but you have every single animal on the food chain except humans growing to these, you know, dangerous man-eating levels, I think even given that, we could still survive it, but I think it would be a lot more dangerous, a lot tougher, and you would see a lot more death. And I think I proposed this theory to Adam, and he was even suggesting that you would have a fallout from, like a nuclear fallout from, you know, having to utilize that kind of weapon to deal with
the meteor.
That, and then, so I think that could be one idea of how that could be a little bit more feasible.
If the military, it wasn't actually that the military got defeated, it was just whatever they released from the meteor, whether or not it was chemical or viral or what other material, killed off a large enough segment of the human population that we just weren't in a position to defend ourselves as other organisms started to rise up.
Yeah. That's...
It's that, but they also say specifically at the beginning of the movie that the big ones and the militaries wiped each other out.
Right.
So there was like probably a Godzilla-sized cockroach.
Yeah, that's the thing. I would have liked to see some of these big ones that they're talking about. I mean, look, this movie was made for, like, I think $30 million.
Really?
So I get that.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think it looks incredible for $30
million. It looks great for $30
million. The snail alone.
Yeah, but I would have liked to see more of those big ones.
Yeah, and I think to that point, I think the movie should have taken place and would have been a lot more interesting and would have worked a little bit more from the danger side of things if it happened immediately. So we got that brief scene where his... You know, and with his parents in the car, and you see that massive thing just absolutely curb stomp that vehicle into oblivion. And the movie that brought to mind was The Mist. If you haven't seen that, very frustrating movie. But you have that moment in which all of a sudden all these creatures are here, and like, what do you do? You're stuck in a grocery store, you're stuck at your parents' house, you know, you're stuck at Makeout Point, like, you know, and I think that's where it realistically would have been able to happen from a story point. And then you have the year to follow them like battling, you know, even in scenes in The Mist, you know, spoiler alert, but
actual spoilers. If you haven't seen the movie, don't listen.
Yeah. At the very end, you do see the military winning, you know, and this is just in like the course of a couple days. So
it is. Yeah. It's interesting because we looked at this with the Quiet Place monsters. The fact that, these things can't possibly be bulletproof or anything. And also, you know, their weakness to sound is the first thing that scientists would have checked out. With these creatures, I mean, if they are just big insects, what's stopping them going in with, like, napalm and just firebombing?
Nothing. They're shooting these things with crossbows and made-up weapons because they're out of guns. And he flips a crab using a metal barbecue prong thing.
Yeah. It was a crab fork.
It's supposed to weigh 10 tons.
Right. It's pulling a boat, and he just secures himself in sand. All right? Like, not a secure substrate at all to try and, like, hold yourself down in. His little Dylan O'Brien arms.
I did like the payoff at the end, though, because there's like the kind of, I don't know, Chekhov snail, if you want to call it, that's laid earlier in the movie, whereby the little girl brings up the fact that some of the creatures are quite kind, or just, I don't think they're kind, I think they just don't
based
care.
On their eyes.
Based on their eyes, which was a bit of wank. But you know what? As much as I was like, oh, this is stupid, I enjoyed the payoff of that, where, you know, he releases the crab at the end and the crab goes and eats the bat.
I'm on Sam's side here. I really like
Adam's, that. Adam's got some grumpy face again here.
That part was such horseshit.
Well, I just wanted to see the crab. The biggest complaint I had was they gave, like, the crab human eyes. So that was like, oh, it's, like, really nice because it looks like human eyes. I just wanted to see these like giant crab stalks with like beady eyes and him looking into this giant black orb being like, it's kind.
On that note, completely off, I rewatched that crab scene last night, and the crab legs attached to it, it looks like a apple resting on toothpicks. Like when it pulls itself up on the beach, it's got these tiny little legs and this enormous body that's like jumping up on it. And I'm like, has the people who made this ever seen a crab before? Cause like they don't have these like tiny little legs. Like what
stick crab?
Like anyways,
But I did enjoy that for the most part, like, they just took creatures which have really horrifying traits. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen, like, a chameleon's tongue before, but those things are fucking horrifying. And that, on a large scale, is kind of what they did with the frog.
Yeah.
Like, this thing that can, like, just suck onto something and curl it back in. Not obviously not that slowly.
And also, frogs use the muscles that are attached to their eyeballs to, like, push stuff down their throat. That's why they, like, close their eyes when they're swallowing. And I remember as a child seeing this, like, horrifying video of this, like, giant toad eating a mouse. And it, like, keeps blinking as the mouse just gets pushed further and further down. And I was like, yeah, that would be terrifying.
Another a really horrifying thing, though, is that in some toads, and we're talking about mutations here, so some toads or frogs have a mutation whereby the eyes will actually manifest on the roof of the mouth.
Ew, I saw that.
It's hot, so they have to walk around with their mouth open constantly so they
can
see. I saw that this week. It's disgusting.
It's real gross. Yeah, I thought it was just like the frog was like breathing or eating and the eyes had just gone down a little too far, but no, it's just like that's where they manifest with this mutation. So,
prepare to storm the surface for the Million Mutant March!
Yeah! Move out, Fry! We need our most disgusted mutant leading the charge.
I'll meet you up there. I need to check out something first.
Okay. Violet, you're up front.
Hey!
Anybody got anything else?
No. I think it'd be nice to have a little segment on here of would we recommend these movies.
Ooh.
Well, I mean, I think we've set... Yeah, obviously, yeah, Dave and I recommend this movie. Adam doesn't. Libby, where do you sit? Because you said you didn't hate it.
Would you recommend it?
I think it's one of those movies that if you are bored and just want something kind of entertaining, give it a go. If you're looking for really great writing, a quality narrative, probably give it a pass. I think it's a very fun world. And I think that's what made me like it was, the world that he's in. But I think the storyline, I couldn't care less.
Fair enough. Yeah. I really liked it. I heard, okay. So our mate over at, Kaiju Weekly, Trav, Alexander, had a really good take on the main character. It's like what Shia LaBeouf in Transformers should have been going for.
Just screaming and running.
Yeah, but not like, obviously Adam feels that this guy was still really annoying. I just thought he was great. I thought he was fantastic.
I enjoyed the not having the superpowered protagonist. And I do agree with that. I enjoyed watching this guy be like, I'm going to totally make it from like one side to the other because like, I'm in love. And everyone's like, you're an idiot. Something's going to eat you.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, love will get me.
And again, I maintain, like, is he in love or is he just really horny?
Right.
No, he's in love. I think Libby and I talked about this last night after we watched it. He is an emotionally stunted individual who is trapped in this, whatever 17-year-old, listen, hear me out. Whatever 17-year-old, 18-year-old, whatever age he and Amy were when this all happened 7 years ago, he is trapped in that stage of his emotional development. He has not acknowledge that she could grow as a person, that he can grow as a person.
Yeah, that's
like he is almost like, and it's kind of that thing that I think that got really popular in the 2010s because of Zooey Deschanel's character in New Girl, was just that quirky, borderline dysfunctional, like maybe they're trying to play them as on the spectrum type character of like they cannot function as a
manic pixie dream girl.
Yeah, manic pixie. He was a manic pixie dream boy.
He was a manic pixie dream boy. And I hated it.
I think Adam brought up a good story alternative, whereas you have the movie actually about,
Clyde and Minnow.
They were fantastic.
Yeah. And sort of their storyline of like her losing her, you know, her dad and him losing his son, I believe.
Son.
And how they can, you know, come together and sort of exist and learn to live in this world and fight for each other. And then they run across this idiot who has just left his bunker and they're getting to know him and maybe like trying to connect with him. And then within 2 seconds he gets eaten and they're like, oh shit.
I'd watch that. I don't need a prequel or a sequel to this, but I would watch the Minnow story. Yeah.
If you like, I would say final thing, if you really like Australian cattle dogs or just dogs in general, absolutely watch this for Boy.
Boy's pretty great.
What a cute dog.
I had a Kelpie when I was younger, and she just reminded me so much. Boy reminded me so much of her. It was wonderful.
As a side note for just a quick, Sam's love of dogs. When Sam lived with me in Canada, we had this point where Sam for a while was talking, and he was like, you know, I'm not sure people should, like, have dogs because environmentally they don't make sense.
No, you always twist the story. What I said was I don't think people should get dogs from pure breeders, which you agree with.
You were talking about dogs as, like, an environmental load and how much, like, pets take when it comes to the environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he, at the same time, Sam's, like, sitting there and he's petting our other roommate, John's dog, Luca. Oh. And I'm like, well, Sam, what about Luca? And Sam's like, well, Luca doesn't count. Luca wouldn't be in this category. I'd make sure that Luca gets whatever Luca wants.
I do think that people should get dogs from, because there's so many dogs that just get, you know, thrown away or killed or put down and that sort of stuff. And I mean, one of Dave's vet friends has made the point before. He's like, Sam, if you go away from professional breeders, what you're setting yourself up for is for a lot of people becoming unprofessional breeders. And I do get that side of it as well. I have, you know, started to have a little more of a nuanced view on the value of pets and that sort of stuff.
As we hear the birds go in the background.
When Jason died 7 days ago, I didn't give a rat's ass.
This is your speech?
Because I didn't understand why people care so much about their dumb dogs. Until I got a dumb dog myself. I've only had Arlo for a day and a half. But if anything happened to him, I would kill everyone in this room and then myself.
Anyway, I think that's about all we have to say on this movie that we all loved unequivocally.
Nope.
Every one of us enjoyed it.
Yeah. Nope.
It's Adam's favorite movie. He wants to watch it again tonight.
It's a trash movie.
Yeah. He never thought he could love a movie like this, and he's reacting very violently to it. Yeah.
That's what this is. Love.
Yeah. No, but hang on. Next week we'll be back, sans moi, and we'll be talking about The Host it's a Bong Joon-ho movie, uh-huh. Right?
Yep.
Yeah. So if anybody enjoyed Parasite,
fantastic.
Oh, so good. One of the best monster movies made.
Yeah. And The Host is also like, I haven't watched it for like 12 years or something, but
same.
I remember loving it when I was 18. It was on SBS every 2 weeks.
That wasn't 12 years ago. Quit lying about your age.
But yeah, we'll be back next week to talk about The Host. Hopefully, yeah, like I said, we'll be delivering these podcasts a little more regularly from now on. And we also have a big, at least two episodes, coming up devoted to, King Kong Godzilla in preparedness for the release of Kong vs. Godzilla.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll talk about that. We'll probably talk about a bit about that next week because we've got some predictions, I'm sure.
Uh-huh.
I hope we see some mecha monsters. I just hope they go full on nuts and go for aliens.
They need to.
Anyway, sorry, Adam, sign us off.
Remember, the monsters aren't real. This movie was shit, but the science is real.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, and just before we finished up, we wanted to say a quick thank you to a few people who sent us kind words about the podcast. To Kari Ann Stickle, who got us on Facebook and said that she's subscribed and is also downloading back catalogue. I love podcasts dissecting movies and podcasts about animals. So, buddy, with like 5 Ys, we appreciate the Ys. You reeled me in good. Thanks also to Damon Noyes. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and probably not, who emailed us with the comment, love your podcast, discovered you through one of the kaiju-themed podcasts I listened to. Sorry, I'm blanking on which one. I assume it was probably Kaiju Weekly. Thanks again to Trev and Michael over at Kaiju Weekly for that. Damon writes, I've looked over your episodes, just started Gremlins/The Mogwai, and I'm seeing a huge gaping hole that needs to be addressed, namely the sandworms of the Dune novels. I'm extremely curious to hear your take on the sand trout sandworm spice ecology that Herbert spent so much time trying to make sound workable. Keep up the good work and keep on raging against bad science. I've never actually seen Dune. I don't know about the rest of us. My wife is insisting it's a good movie. I'll probably have to watch the original before the new one comes out. But thanks for writing in, Damon. And also a big thanks as always to, we've already mentioned him a couple of times, Trev Alexander. He sent us in a question basically saying he was curious about the science behind the mutations themselves. Whatever it is affects vertebrates and invertebrates, reptiles, amphibians, crustaceans, insects and mollusks are all affected, but not dogs, humans, birds or other species. And how is the food chain affected by the sudden mutation of growth of so many different creatures? We didn't bring it up earlier because I think we pretty much covered this during the episode. But yeah, thanks to everyone who got in touch and had questions. Please continue doing that, whether by email, Twitter, or just contacting us via the websites. We really enjoy when people kind of show appreciation and and have, you know, questions for us that they're genuinely curious about. So please keep it up.
How far away is Amy's colony?
85 miles. It's an impossible journey. Everything. We'll try to kill you. Don't fight. Just run and hide.
Okay. You all alone?
Me too. You don't have to talk about it.
You want to come with me? Is that a samurai sword?
Yeah, it is.
Yes, it is. Listen to your instincts out here, man.
What if I have terrible instincts?
You'll die.
Super encouraging speech.
You made it all this way for a girl, huh? You ever hear the term fool's errand?
No! Amy, I miss you so much.
We have lost this war.
We could still take our world back.
You're more of a survivor than I thought.